Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. I'm Tim Ford. I represent the appellants in this case, and I'd like to save 4 minutes, please, for rebuttal.
First, I have a point of clarification. It's probably a minor point, but as I understand it, the appellants are the four individual attorneys, not their law firms. Is that correct?
No, I believe the appellants are all of the...
It's not a trick question. I just want a clarification, because the order talks about attorneys. In your brief, you refer to four individual attorneys, and I just want to know who's
everyone before. Who is subject to the sanctions. We have a little bit of a problem in the case overriding about the lack of findings, but all the sanctions, anyone who had the sanction imposed,
okay.
We're appealing on behalf of,
okay.
That include the firms, I believe. But I'm not sure you can impose a sanction on a law firm, but I guess if we had more specific findings, we would know that.
That's one of the reasons why I asked. At minimum, it's four individual attorneys.
Yes,
okay. Thanks.
I think the dispositive question in this case and the overriding question is whether a lawyer can simultaneously act in a fiduciary capacity for one party and act as the attorney for another party, opposing party, an adverse party. Specifically, an insurance company.
Let me just ask you to first deal with the negligent misrepresentation claim. There are two bases, as I understand, and the question I have is why there is an abuse of discretion for by the trial court under CR 11 in imposing sanctions for the negligent misrepresentation claim made against counsel.
Apart from the whole question of no findings, which is, of course, a separate issue that I think overrides everything, but on terms of the negligent misrepresentation claim, the trial court was clearly off base in its ruling. What she kept saying was the reason that she's dismissing negligent misrepresentation is there could not be justifiable reliance because the person was represented by another lawyer at the time. That's not correct. The complaint said that the misrepresentations and the actionable conduct occurred before the client had a lawyer.
Okay.
That was the whole point.
But, and my understanding from reading the arguments that were written and orally advanced below was that the focus of that claim was the three letters that were sent by counsel to Ms. Alvarez with respect to the scheduling of the examination under oath.
That's correct.
Is there anything other than those three letters that was the basis for making the negligent misrepresentation claim?
No, all the misrepresentations were prior to the representation of Ms. Alvarez by counsel, my client.
Okay. And so my question is, what with respect to any of those letters was false? What was anything on which Ms. Alvarez detrimentally relied?
Well, she was given unequivocal statement by Mr. Wathen that she was required to appear for an examination under oath. Mr. Wathen cited a case that had been overruled by the Supreme Court on that exact point, a case called Downey, and it was overruled by a case called Staples. So that was the misrepresentation. Remember, though, that wasn't the basis for the argument that was made by the defendants. Originally, and so the that was this all changed when they made their reply to the summary judgment, and then it changed again during oral argument when the trial court really inserted, I think, what was her own view with regard to which elements were missing.
With respect,
with a clear misrepresentation that she had to appear, and that there was no question about it, when in fact the Staples case had held that she didn't, and then in fact in circumstances very much like this, an insurance company did not have the authority to order an examination under oath.
What is the evidence in the record, if any, that she detrimentally relied on what you just mentioned, the case that was apparently subsequently modified by a ruling?
I don't know that there is any, other than, of course, her action after that third letter of going to get counsel and to try and, you know, deal with that and then incur that expense. But
and why?
The argument was not made. That wasn't the basis for the motion. That Mr. Wathen made was that there had been no reliance. The basis for the motion was different, that there hadn't been a contractual relationship and you can't sue people under the Consumer Protection Act. So when the plaintiffs came back and said, well, here's our evidence responding to that, and here's our arguments responding to that, you're clearly wrong, then there was an attempt to change that and say, well, there's no evidence of reliance.
Okay,
and
so
the trial court changed it again and said, even if I assume there was evidence of reliance, it's not justifiable because you're represented by counsel. But she was just wrong. She wasn't represented by counsel.
Well, with respect to the detrimental reliance that Ms. Alvarez allegedly suffered, you're saying is going to an attorney to represent her was detrimental reliance? Is that what you're saying?
You know, factually, in the record, we don't have anything from Ms. Alvarez. We do have the trial court saying, I'm assuming there was detrimental reliance, but it's not justifiable. So, again, it shifted, and then it shifted again. So there's no real opportunity to say this is the reliance. But in fact, you know, what we're talking about here and the reason this generated so much heat is this is a business practice of these lawyers that they used before the Sedell case where they could exploit their position as attorneys as well as taking these examinations under oath, make these exorbitant demands for documents, tell the plaintiff that they have or the claimant that they have no choice in the matter, and our allegation and the client's allegation was to do that, they're in fact defrauding them and giving them bad advice. Remember, they're in a fiduciary, quasi-fiduciary relationship with her, and they're telling her, you have to do this. It's just like it would be legal malpractice if they were a lawyer, but they're not. They were her fiduciary, and that's why they claimed negligent misrepresentation. Thank you.
Okay. You had reserved 4 minutes, I think?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Mark Cole, representing the respondents, Mr. Wathen and the firm. There was no negligent there was no legitimate case of negligent misrepresentation for the reasons that we were just talking about. The sole allegation is that there were three letters from Mr. Wathen. No oral communications by Mr. Wathen. Everything was in the letters and on the record. Those three letters, when you read them, the first letter says, Allstate is requesting an examination under oath pursuant to policy and to statute. Now, it turns out that there is a policy that had language that allowed for the examination under oath. In addition, there's a statute that permits an examination under oath on any claim brought under an insurance policy. So Mr. Wathen's letter was 100% accurate. Allstate was asking for an examination under oath pursuant to the provisions of one of the policies and also pursuant to the statute, which covers that other policy. So
Those documents that you just referred to, the statute and so forth, policy, specifically authorize this kind of broad request for documents that's in the letter?
The statute doesn't address the broad the statute does not address a broad request for documents.
I mean, this is a broad request for documents. On page 2 of the letter, wouldn't you agree?
Well, it was a necessary request for documents because there was a lot of legitimate questions that were raised about this claim, including the fact that the property, as it turns out, she was evicted after the eviction. When she left, that property became the property of the landlord, so she no longer had an insurable interest in that property, or at least that was Allstate's legitimate contention.
Let me shift your focus to the other bases for imposition of sanctions, and that was that with respect to the Consumer Protection Act claim, there was no existing law that supported that claim and no facts to support it. My understanding of the record is, again, that the factual basis for that Consumer Protection Act claim was at minimum the three letters that we're talking about now. Is that correct?
That's my understanding as well.
Is it your understanding that there was anything else in the record that was the basis of the Consumer Protection Act claim?
It's my That is my understanding as well.
That there was no other, or that there was some other? For example, the examination under oath, was there something that happened there that served as a basis for the claim as you understand it?
My understanding is that it was just the three letters. There is nothing that happened in the examination under oath that would give rise to that. And I believe that there was an argument made that the plaintiff's attorneys had no problem with what Mr. Wathen did after they came on board. They came on board after the three letters. So to answer your question, I believe it's just the three letters, nothing untoward in the examination under oath or what happened later, because she was represented by counsel from that point on. They allege that there was that Mr. Wathen engaged in an unfair act by misrepresenting Allstate's right to an examination under oath. But again, the wording of the one policy was clear, they have a right to an exam. The statute is clear that they had the right to an examination under oath. In addition, after the attorneys came on board, Mr. Wathen produced certified copies of the policies. He provided them with the citation to the statute. They had a full chance to look at everything. The examination under oath went forward with Ms. Alvarez represented by counsel, and there was nothing on the record where there was an objection to the examination under oath going forward. And in the briefs filed with this court, there's no assignment of error that Allstate had a right to the exam, and there's no issue assigned to Allstate had the right. So there was no unfair act or practice, as they allege.
What did the complaint allege as far as injury or damages from the causes of action?
Just that she suffered some sort of injury or damage. It was unspecified.
I see. Counsel, Mr. Ford has emphasized, although hasn't really had a chance to talk about, the absence of written findings, but I believe his point is that that's an overarching defect in the whole.
Your Honor, my reading, yes, and
because there was some shifting of argument from time to time. It started out with being one thing and then went to another, and under the White versus Kent rule, you can't do that.
Well, my recollection, I will apologize in advance. I meant to get the citation that says there's no findings of fact and conclusions of law are not required in a CR 11 circumstance. But my general reading of the cases, and I will give you my argument, that the cases say that if the record below is sufficient and establishes, you know, everything you need, then findings of fact and conclusions of law are not necessary in a CR 11. And in this situation, we have, you know, all the pleadings. The clerk's papers are very complete. We have a full transcript of all of the proceedings before the trial court. And in addition, if there was any question about Mr. Wathen's communications with Ms. Alvarez, it was just three letters, no verbal communications. That's also in the record.
So let me ask you this then, assuming that's all so. But one of the, in reading the record, there was, when the trial court was conducting the hearing about CR 11, there's extensive discussion of a bar letter, bar complaint, and the bar's answer, and so forth. And it sounded as if the trial court was, to some degree, resting the finding of CR 11 sanctions on that exchange. And how could the plaintiffs be so clueless as to come in and make this argument when they had been warned by the bar? But I have a difficult time equating the issue. I mean, I understood that the issue with the bar was the lawyers were contacting Allstate, knowing Allstate to be represented, which doesn't seem to be part of the issue here about whether this was a legitimate complaint to begin with based on the Siddell-type notion.
Right.
So should we just disregard that bar letter?
No, but for reasons different than I think you're getting at. The importance of the bar letter was this, that there was this matter of Mr. Wathen calling the bar on an RPC violation by one of the attorneys. Okay. Then what happened was, and this is why there was this big argument, is the plaintiff attorneys in talking to the trial court, to Judge Schaefer, said, oh, that bar complaint was dismissed as unfounded. That was false. And if you read the bar letter and so forth, it was not dismissed. The bar took it very seriously, and they only...
I understand what you're saying. I get that. And so the trial court was...
The trial court was troubled with the misrepresentation.
Right, lack of candor. But that's a different basis than no possibility, you know, of extension of existing law here, completely unfounded or baseless filing of a Consumer Protection and Negligent Misrepresentation Act against your client.
I think I'm not quite following your argument.
Well, okay. Let me be more clear then. I mean, one of the opposition arguments here is shifting basis for CR 11 sanctions. Okay, so lack of findings is the argument. So what is it? Are we upset with counsel because they were not candid with the court about the bar letter, or are we upset with counsel because they filed a completely baseless and harebrained and half-baked complaint that had no basis in existing law?
The latter, Your Honor.
Then why should we even care about the bar letter, except to the extent of maybe wondering whether the trial court actually knew what basis she was imposing the sanctions on?
I think that the main concern was that the filing of the complaint against Mr. Wathen and the law firm was baseless, not well-grounded in fact. The only importance to the bar thing was that it was one of three misrepresentations that these plaintiff attorneys made to the court trying to squirm out of CR 11 sanctions. And, yeah, I think that when you make misrepresentations to the court, that, I believe, can be an independent basis for a CR 11 sanction as well.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you.
Let me start with that. It really is disturbing how these things keep getting said, even though they're discounted. John Strait, professor of law at Seattle U, has an affidavit. It's in the record, and it was before the trial court on reconsideration. It says a dismissal by the bar, ELC 5.7A, is a dismissal. That's what it is. There was no misrepresentation about that. The underlying problem is the same problem the bar had, I think the trial court had, maybe Mr. Wathen had. The Sedell case dramatically changed the law. The Sedell case said that you can't have this dual relationship. And so if you try and have this dual relationship, you lose attorney-client privilege. And then since then, federal courts have said you also lose work product privilege. And the question then is, do you also lose the protections that you might otherwise have from civil liability as the lawyer for a, quote, opposing party? Because
Well, what does that mean? Does it mean that, this kind of letter can't be set out by somebody who isn't an Allstate employee, or can it not be sent out at all?
No, it can be sent out, but the person who sends it out is subject to Consumer Protection Act liability if they violate the Consumer Protection Act in sending it out. They're not practicing law. They're engaged in the investigation of a claim for an insurance company.
So if an Allstate investigator, somebody who was working for Allstate and had that title, and they sent this letter out, you'd say you'd have
There's no. I don't think there's even any question about that. And that's why the whole argument was can't sue attorneys. But Sedell says, yes, you can. And Kalina says you can. Many cases say you can.
Why?
Unfair and deceptive and cause injury to the plaintiff to receive this letter?
Well, again, I noticed we had another case that was in a very different posture just before on Rule 11. This case was right out of the blocks. There was never any proceedings prior to the demand that they dismiss this lawsuit. So then there were all these changing reasons why these claims should fail, which never got litigated, ultimately never got litigated because counsel had to withdraw and Ms. Alvarez let the case go. So we don't know the answer to those things.
Well,
but what we do know is what Mr.
Let me ask a question. Time is short here. With respect to the claim that the lawyer was acting in an investigatory capacity, does that mean a lawyer cannot conduct discovery on behalf of a client?
No.
For a case?
No, that's different.
Why is it different?
Because there was no case, because they're acting as an investigator, because Sedell says there's no case.
So prior to the filing and service of a complaint, an attorney is not allowed to do any investigation on behalf of a client on a case?
No, when they are doing an investigation in a role that puts them in a fiduciary relationship with the person investigated. That's what Sedell says. And
well,
lawyer would, Sedell would not...
Sedell talks about the attorney-client privilege, and what I'm trying to tease out here is it appears that your argument for an extension of law presupposes that an attorney cannot be involved in any respect in a pre-filing investigation.
Oh, absolutely not. No, it's only the kind of investigation that Sedell covers because of the quasi-fiduciary relationship. An attorney that's just investigating an opposing party that they have no relationship with is still the attorney for the person that they're working for. But Sedell says when they're taking a role on that puts them in a fiduciary relationship with the person investigated, they can't claim the protections of attorney-client privilege. And this was a perfect example of what we're supposed to do under Rule 11, which is say, okay, we say no work attorney-client privilege, and then the courts have also said no work product privilege. Does that also mean no special protection from CPA liability and negligent misrepresentation? That's a fair argument for the expansion of law. That's what they were trying to do here in a very express and open way, and that's what the trial court didn't understand.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I believe that concludes our docket for the day. The court will be at recess.
All rise. Court is in recess.